In our practice with homebound individuals, often that community dimension is absent. There are, of course, some individuals that are content living solitary lives, and that's fine. But 1 in 3 older adults does live alone, and 1 in 3 older adults experiences loneliness.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, and you're listening to Into the Fold, Issues in Mental Health. The Hogg Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. How do communities create mental health and well-being? There is no one-size-fits-all blueprint, but a good measuring stick is whether older people have the same ability as everyone else to thrive in communities that support their mental health and well-being. Indeed, with record numbers of Americans now living to age 90 and beyond, our ability to provide for the mental as well as physical health of this population must be strengthened if we're to create healthy communities now and in the future. Joining us today, Carly Bassett, a licensed clinical social worker and counselor with Family Elder Care here in Austin. The month of June is Alzheimer's and Brain Awareness Month, and with this month's focus on older people, there's no better time to enlarge the discussion to include mental health and overall well-being. And Carly is here to help us do that. Carly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What is your background with this population and what led you to your current work?
Well, like you said, I am a social worker and I have been working with older adults and people at end of life for over 10 years. Presently, I am a psychotherapist at Family Elder Care and also a field instructor for master's level students from the UT Steve Hicks School of Social Work. So training kind of the next generation of gerontologists in mental health. What we do at our agency that's unique is we serve older adults who are homebound. So we're literally doing therapy at people's kitchen tables or in their living rooms. And it's really neat. I would say, like most people in my field and working with this population, I was called to it based on my own personal experiences and relationships with older adults in my own life, particularly my grandmother. What I noticed when my grandmother aged into her 90s was that even with a loving family and relatively good health, there were still, you know, struggles with that experience, and especially a loneliness and isolation to that process. And so as she navigated that, I noticed as a family, it was a really scary and uncertain time and brought up a lot of fears and anxieties that I'm now seeing with the population I serve. Things like, you know, where will I live? Will I outlast my money? Will I be a burden? And so on. And so in the last year of her life, I often talked to her on the phone, and one time she was just mulling over kind of, what am I going to do? Where am I going to go? Just feeling really anxious. And I had nothing to offer her except to listen. And so I kind of felt powerless. But what she told me was, she said, you're the only one I have to talk to. You're the only one who understands. And I was kind of like, I don't really understand. I don't know what else to do besides listen. And that's really the cornerstone of my practice and what has kind of guided me to where I am. And I hear those same words from the clients that I see regularly, that I don't have anyone to talk to. You're the only person that understands. And so that's a pretty big responsibility, but one that I think is important. And I think that it's monumental because we as individuals can really hold space for older adults and be there to support them through, you know, this life phase.
And so just regarding the scope of the issue, what can we say about the mental health of older people compared to the general population?
Well, first of all, I think there's something that might come as a surprise, that studies show that most people tend to report better emotional stability as they age across the lifespan.
Yeah. So, and I think I've seen.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Those kinds of studies. Yeah.
And they also self-report, you know, having better health and having less stress, which, you know, I think also can be surprising to people. So given that, I think that's positive. But we still see about 20% of the older adult population, so like one in five over the age of 55, dealing with some sort of mental health concern. Among those, I would say anxiety is probably one of the most dominant ones we see. Anxiety is twice as common as dementia and six times more common than major depression in an older adult population. The other significant piece to mention is about suicide rates. So within the older adult population, we're seeing suicide rates at about four times higher than the general population, with the highest being older men, age 85 and up. That's actually the highest rate, which is, I think, six times more than the general population. So we really need to probably talk more about that in general and give more focus to that group.
So you just mentioned dementia. And as you know, aging is often associated with cognitive decline. But things like difficulty concentrating, confusion, personality changes are also one of the hallmark symptoms of depression. Is this a way that depression among older people can fly under the radar? Or I guess, does it take some work to tease out mental health from the cognitive decline that we stereotypically associate with older people?
Absolutely. I think depression can often look like a lot of different things, especially in this older adult population. And one interesting piece is that they say that physicians often miss depression in older adults about half of the time. So from a sense of, you know, physicians aren't assessing or diagnosing depression in their patients who they're seeing routinely, that's problematic. So I think it's going under the radar there. And for older adults, there can be some ambiguity in symptoms. So they may not even, you know, think that it would be something to bring up to a physician or to tell somebody about, because they may think that it's a normal part of aging, or they may be afraid that it means something bigger or scarier than they're, you know, wanting to address.
So I do not think that a lot of people would disagree with the idea that sadness or anxiousness should be seen as a normal part of aging. So you're preaching to the converted to that extent, right? In spite of that, are there more subtle or implicit anti-aging biases that can creep into our language or our work with this population? And do you have any examples?
Yeah, so I think, you know, you're right. We have to be careful about pathologizing sadness and and also accepting that or believing that depression is a normal part of aging, because it isn't. We see a lot of older adults living very rewarding, active lives. Some of the areas where we hear language that's biased, I would say, is around loss. So loss of spouse, particularly when you have older adults who've been married for, you know, 30, 40, even 50 years, it can be really hard to navigate that loss. And so, you know, you hear sometimes like, oh, they had a good life, or it was their time. And that can be really harmful to, you know, widows or widowers who are trying to get through that. They deserve kind of the same attention and empathy that, you know, anybody would dealing with a loss. The other would be this assumption or feeling like, you know, older adults just have to accept the facts that, you know, they're getting old and they have to change, or maybe they have to downsize or move or lose independence. We often just think that those are normal parts of aging, when in fact, a lot of older adults remain independent and they stay in their homes. And I think, you know, sometimes there can be risks but we have to ask ourselves, do those risks outweigh the benefits of living independently? And I think for a lot of people, they do.
So, yeah, so you just mentioned that, you know, older people value their independence. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that I wonder is what barriers there are to effective treatment, maybe in particular for those who value their mm-hmm. independence. Mm-hmm. And what are some ways around those?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think an older generation may not have kind of our belief systems. You know, you think back 50 years ago.
Yeah.
People weren't talking about mental health. And if they were, it was pretty negative. They might have ideas about mental health and people being institutionalized. And so those deep-rooted belief systems create a lot of barriers for that generation to access mental health these days. So ways we can get around that. I think recognizing self-sufficiency as a strength is important. A lot of people kind of want to handle it on their own. And I think we can utilize that survivorship is a strength, and ask them questions around, you know, what would seeking treatment look like for you? And how can we use your strengths to improve your situation? Reducing stigma, of course, is critical. Building trust with older adults is really important too. And I think in that, ensuring confidentiality. One of the things that I hear often on my first visit with people is this fear of, you're not going to tell anyone, you're not going to tell my kids I'm in counseling, you're not going to share this with my nurse or another provider. They're so afraid that anything they say will be used against them, or that would be sort of ammunition to use to put them into a nursing home, for example. And I try to tell them, actually, engaging in this kind of work and counseling and support can help you stay more independent. So it's, in fact, the opposite of that. And so really establishing trust and pushing that idea of confidentiality is crucial for working with older adults.
I have always thought that civic and community engagement is a crucial dimension of well-being. And that the lack of it contributes to the kind of alienation that can impact mental health. So, beyond any specific diagnosis, what are some non-clinical ways of engaging this population that you found to be particularly effective?
Mm-hmm. I would say in our practice with homebound individuals, often that community dimension is absent. There are, of course, some individuals that are content living solitary lives, and that's fine. But 1 in 3 older adults does live alone, and 1 in 3 older adults experiences loneliness. So tangible ways that anybody can help support older adults, primarily making transportation available. That could include just offering a ride to the grocery store, helping them maintain normalcy and independence, offering a ride to church. Oftentimes, older adults become disconnected from their faith communities, which had been central to their lives and their well-being. Creating opportunities for connection with others. So some older adults live in facilities or community living environments. Encouraging dining with other people is important. And also just promoting a sense of purpose. So volunteer opportunities are one way. Taking care of a pet would be another way. I see a lot of dogs and cats that are really helpful in supporting mental well-being in older adults.
So do you have a personal story that illustrates for you what a positive outcome looks like for the people who you work with?
Yes. Yeah, so I have two stories, and they're both a little different.
Well, let's hear them.
Okay. And they both are positive outcomes. So earlier you mentioned just the importance of civic and community engagement as being critical. And we have a client who lost her spouse to Alzheimer's, and soon after she had to sell her home and move from her community and neighborhood and into an apartment in a different city. And at the same time, she was dealing with a lot of chronic illness, which unfortunately made her unable to drive. So this kind of created the perfect scenario for loneliness leading to depression. Through accepting counseling and mental health services, we were able to process her experience of loss and, you know, talk about regrets that she'd had in her life. And one of those regrets was not having engaged in the political scene and engaged in her community. And so this lady was, you know, in her late 70s. She was using a walker. And this is around, you know, the midterms this fall. And she kept talking about how she wanted to give back. And so we spent some time, you know, figuring out what would that look like for you? And so one day, late October, I showed up to do our weekly visit, and there was a sign on the door, and this young man answered, and he said, "Oh, are you here to volunteer?" And I said, "No, I'm not." And apparently, you know, she had basically decided to open up her apartment to become a field office for this campaign. And her apartment was kind of this 7-day-a-week, 12-hour-a-day phone bank, block walk hub of volunteers and people coming and going and supporting this cause and this candidate. And it was really inspiring, and she was just loving it. And so that went on for a couple weeks. And then, of course, the election came, and that night I'm watching the returns and realized that the candidate did not win. So the next day when I went to see her for our visit, I had a sense of dread of, you know, fear that she would maybe sink into a depression after having put so much energy into this cause. But she opened the door and had the biggest smile on her face. And she said that being engaged and a part of this was really one of the best experiences she'd had in her entire life, that because of the people coming and going and the volunteers in her home from all walks of life, she had made friends that she thought she'd have for the rest of her life. And the other part of this, which I think is a huge positive outcome, that she reported decreased depression and also increased physical mobility through that engagement and being involved in something that she felt was important. So it was really inspiring.
Okay, yeah, it sounds like it.
So the last story I will share with you is slightly different. This was a client I had worked with for years, somebody who had chronic mental health issues, including agoraphobia and anxiety and depression, somebody who had never worked and had never driven due to the mental health issues that she faced. So she was living independently, but extremely isolated and really dependent on community resources and systems to be able to maintain her independence. And so she and I formed a bond, and she didn't have many relationships. So I had seen her every week for years without fail, and we really connected. The work that I did with her was not very deep in terms of clinical work, but what I did for her was provide a relationship that she could depend on. It was consistent. It was supportive. I listened. We did problem solving. And she knew I would show up for her every week. And so this spring, she passed away suddenly. And that was hard. And I went into my notes to kind of close out her case and file. And I went back and read through the notes from our first visit several years earlier. And what I always ask clients when I meet them is, tell me about your social support systems. And what she said was, I have no friends. I've never had a friend due to my agoraphobia. And so as I read that line, I just, you know, grief kind of filled my body. And I felt so much sadness for her that had been her experience in her life. So a couple days later, I received a phone call from a relative of hers who knew we had worked together. And she said, I just wanted to thank you. She said, you were such a good friend to her. And when I heard that, I was kind of taken aback, because as clinicians, you know, we don't want to become friends with our clients. We're not supposed to be. But when I thought about what that really meant, you know, counseling feels supportive. It feels like a relationship. It is a relationship. She felt seen and she felt heard. And that's what friendship feels like. And so to me, when I think about that, those years, what better positive outcome for her than to have experienced something that felt like friendship in the final years of her life?
Okay, so I have been with the Hogg Foundation for about 6.5 years. Mm-hmm. This is by far the deepest dive that we've had the opportunity to take into the issue mm-hmm. of the mental health of older adults. And so we really appreciate you, being the one to...
Thank you.
to enlarge our lens just a little bit and make it a little bit clearer for this important population. Also, I would say a linchpin for what it is that we've been saying about community and well-being. So we appreciate it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
For additional resources, you can find a couple of blog posts related to elderly mental health on our website. That's hogg.utexas.edu. I have included links in the episode description. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on iTunes and sign up for the podcast email. You can find more at hogg.utexas.edu/news-resources/podcast. Thanks so much for joining us.